You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you later on in the program. Chris Andrews is going to drop by in our second hour. This is one of those stories. You know, the first couple of times I got one of these kind of viral emails about this, the Senate is planning to pass legislation that would allow the federal government to lock up anyone, anywhere, for any reason, well, actually for the reason that they say you're a terrorist, without a trial, without a judge, without a court, without nothing, and keep you there forever. And I thought, this can't be. And then I got two or three more, and then I started getting them from people that I thought, you know, this wasn't just like somebody I'd never heard of, but it was like, you know, actual reporters and things, and I'm going, whoa. So Chris Anders, the senior legislative counsel with the Washington office, legislative office of the ACLU, it actually is true. It is part of, as of this moment, the defense authorization bill, the military defense authorization bill that just came out of a Senate committee. There is an amendment to strip that out. We'll get into that in our second hour. Cory Booker is going to be here as well, the mayor of Newark. He's got some interesting stuff going on. The front page of today's Financial Times, an amazing story I want to tell you about. What's going on in India, how they're trying to avoid becoming Walmartized. And this is really extraordinary. And, of course, the Occupy movements, we're seeing now some significant victories, I would say. And in Los Angeles, for example, Eric Beiler's on the line with us. He's a filmmaker, the co-founder of Coffee Party USA, coffeepartyusa.com, of course, their website. And Eric was there in L.A. during the confrontation with the Los Angeles Police Department. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I understand that the difference between the Los Angeles Police Department confrontation, apparently Villaraigosa and his police department are having some coherent communication, was quite different than, for example, Oakland. That well, you tell the story. Tell us what happened.
Well, in Oakland, they have a deteriorating relationship, sorry about my voice, between the community and law enforcement. I think in Los Angeles, the relationship is improving. And I think that the Los Angeles Police Department has actually been showing leadership in something called community police work that involves forming relationships of trust with all elements of the community, of color, especially because trust has broken down in the past. I think Villaraigosa was a little bit stung by some events from 2007, May Day immigration rallies at MacArthur Park. And so he has definitely instructed law enforcement to make sure to protect the rights of the protesters and their safety. And what I witnessed was, I think, the most professional approach to what became a battleground was this intersection of Main Street and First Street, and the police needed to clear the street in order to allow traffic to follow, and they were able to do that with no one getting hurt and only four arrests.
So in Oakland, it was mutant teenage Ninja Turtle outfits. It was full riot gear and tear gas and rubber bullets. In Los Angeles, were the police just dressed as cops?
They wore helmets. And they had batons.
But other than that, they were not decked out in SWAT uniforms.
Well, I have to say the sight of hundreds of police officers who are armed with helmets was one of the most frightening things I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. South of First Street, there was a line. It happens that the LAPD headquarters is right across the street from the occupied camp.
Hmm.
And so there was a line. Actually, they had earlier in the evening blocked off every direction except for east. As it got toward 4:35 in the morning, when they, you know, basically they had announced that they're not going to enter the camps, that the only reason that they're there is to remove people from the streets. Now, LAPD had created the situation where the streets were full by doing two things. One, blocking off traffic so people could walk in the streets, and two, creating this line that looked like it could be the staging ground for an invasion. It really kind of did. And so the occupiers felt like they had to confront that line. And many of them actually sat down Indian style, sort of like that horrible footage we saw of UC Davis. Yeah. And so we were all kind of afraid that something would happen. And when these, when like hundreds of police officers amassed behind that line about 200 yards south and then began to march toward us, I was really concerned that there would be panic. I think the protesters handled themselves well. Many of them, you know, I think were verbally disrespectful and sort of behaving like high school students in the principal's office or at an assembly. But the police officers just let it roll off their back. And even when there were things thrown at the police officers that could have injured them, pieces of wood that were pretty large, they did not lose their composure, and they managed to keep things under control.
So, bottom line, no police riot, and the camp is still there, and now it's going to court, I understand. It's going to be adjudicated on Thursday or Friday?
Yeah, and it was very quiet last night in the camp, and I'm going to visit again today before I see you this evening at your LA studio.
Yeah, okay. Great. And we're talking with Eric Beiler, the filmmaker and co-founder of Coffee Party USA. And the carry-home message is that what this, it seems to me, is that what this proves is that the riot police trash the people and the scene techniques used in Oakland and in New York City and a few other cities around the United States, Denver and others, are unnecessary.
I think so, absolutely. I think each department is going to approach it differently, and I think each officer will approach it differently. And where I have concern is when you see really disgusting police brutality on the internet, and then you take that as an excuse to treat all police officers that way or assume all police officers is that way. It really sort of reminds me of the way that people on the far right will take one thing that an immigrant did and then say we need to treat all immigrants in that way. So I hope that we can improve relationships between law enforcement and the occupiers, because they really are all part of the 99%.
Well, you tweeted about this one cop who, you know, studied chemistry and wanted to be a doctor and ended up being a police officer. On the one hand, yeah, there very much is an element of every single one of those people is a human being, an individual, and probably just an average middle class, you know, a schlub sounds negative, but you know what I mean, you know, just an average guy, or man or woman. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that was also a description of the people who cleared the Warsaw Ghetto in 1939, 1940, and there's this weird groupthink that happens when people are given uniforms and the power of to use violence that kind of shifts them into a different headspace. And it seems to me that the management, that flows from the top down, and that the mayor and the chief of police helped create an atmosphere among their own officers that allowed them to maintain their humanity. Am I making sense here?
Yeah. I mean, my biggest concern is actually above that top, at the top of the 1% media back in D.C., where I normally am. I witnessed a similar altercation at Occupy DC not long after the sniper had shot at the White House, and the police officers were they were actually park police. They were extremely aggressive. I think they handled it well, but the occupiers were also extremely aggressive. And this was all really the result of not police policy so much as it was 1% media outlets creating propaganda stories about Occupy DC to pressure the police chief to say, basically issue a statement that Occupy DC is no longer a peaceful movement. And then when the occupiers heard that, they said, okay, well then the police are no longer our friends. And then suddenly their relationship was compromised. I don't think we can allow 1% media to impose itself for political reasons on the relationship between law enforcement and the community.
Right. And similarly, we need to avoid people, as happened in Oakland and I think to some extent in DC, who are provocateurs. But
yeah.
Eric Beiler, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It was Eric Beiler, CoffeePartyUSA.com. We'll be right back. I got to tell you what's on the front page of today's Financial Times. It's amazing. And what the banksters are up to. Okay, I promised This is absolutely mind-boggling stuff. We are right now in the United States in a depression. One of the things that I've learned in the last week, I thought I knew, we've been talking about economics on this program for the 9 years we've been doing it. I've been writing books about economics for 20 years. I thought I knew this, or at least let me rephrase that. I didn't know that I didn't know this. And that is that the Great Depression was not referred to as the Great Depression until after the 1930s. People looked back and said, holy cow, that was the Great Depression. There was when it started. There was when it ended. In the middle of it, people just thought, Roosevelt referred to it as our current difficulties. We played those clips for you over and over and over again. Our current difficulties, this current crisis. Today we refer to it as the Great Recession. It's a depression. And it's a depression that's been brought about by a whole bunch of things. In large part, this bubble economy, which was, courtesy of Alan Greenspan and Fed policy, courtesy of 30 years of Reaganomics, courtesy of a tax cut on the wealthiest from 70% down to 28% during the Reagan administration that caused people to go into speculative frenzy, courtesy of Phil Gramm, who passed Gramm-Leach-Bliley of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that allowed the banks to go in 1999, having no derivatives out there in the marketplace that were unregulated and in unregulated markets, invisible markets, to having over $800 trillion worth. There's still $500 trillion worth of that stuff out there. This is why Europe is on the edge of collapsing. This is why the United States is on the edge of collapsing. And in the midst of this, India is looking at this. I promised you this front page story. There's two front page stories in the Financial Times today that are really, the first, Singh, this is the Prime Minister of India, faces backlash against opening up India's retail sector. Right now, about 95% of India's entire retail sector, up until a couple of, is small businesses, is local small family-owned businesses. Up until a couple of years ago, it was illegal in India to own more than one or two stores anywhere in the country. Now, they've changed that law so that it is possible to own more than one or two stores, but you still have to be an Indian business, and there are still a lot of restrictions. So still, 95% of their retail sector is small businesses and mom-and-pop shops. Very inefficient. I love inefficiency. I realize, you say this to any conservative or libertarian, and they will say, what, are you crazy? No. A certain small level of inefficiency in a marketplace gives that marketplace elasticity. Highly efficient markets are brittle. And we are watching, and what has happened in the United States over the last 30 years, and monopolistic markets are brittle, is that our marketplaces have come to be dominated by a very, very small number of companies. And when they pop, the whole thing goes down. So here's the story from today's Financial Times, and they just laid it out. Revolt escalates against Indian retail reform. India's government faced a full-scale parliamentary revolt on Monday against its decision to open the country's retail sector to foreign companies. Ferocious political opposition, they talk about this. The idea that Walmart or IKEA might come in a big way. This is just last week's decision to allow majority foreign ownership of supermarket chains and outright foreign control of single brand retail, like, IKEA or one of the shoe companies or clothing companies or whatever. Walmart, Carrefour, Tesco. This is a $450 billion market. And this could bring down the Indian government. Or at least this administration. The fact that they want to say to the big transnational corporations, sure, we'll roll over and do for you what the Americans did. One of the great tragedies of our current crisis is that so many of the people who are being most badly and horribly affected by it, the young people who are graduating from college, you know, with $60,000 in debt, and the best job they can find is paying $16,000 a year working part-time, you know, at a Walmart or something, and they got nothing. That they don't, they're not old enough to remember that before Ronald Reagan came into office, every single strip mall in America was completely different. Every downtown in America was completely different. They were all filled with local stores. They were, you know, it was, you know, Jacobson's Furniture Store. It was Johnson's Clothing Store. It was, well, Stevens and Company. I remember one in Montpelier, Vermont. Jacobson's, I remember from East Lansing. The local bank was locally owned by local people. The entire retail sector was independent and unique. But now we've got these, we've got this oligopoly. We've got this giant, brittle, massive, it's the 1%. The 1% of the people who are feeding off this, so the people who make their paychecks off this, and this is basically the 1% of business too. And when we come back from the break in just a second, I'm going to share with you the kind of profits that were made. Bloomberg just released this. The kind of profits that were made on the $7.7 trillion that the 1%'s buddies on the Fed secretly gave them during the last year of the Bush administration to bail their butts out, but not just to bail them out, to make them profitable. We're going to name names. It's going to make your head explode. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then, of course, the other headline on the front page of the Financial Times, appeal to Germany to save Eurozone. They think they're looking at a holocaust, I mean, the economic holocaust.
And when this is all over, you'll be in coma. We'll go out and spend all of your
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan Grayson, was this an Olbermann show, Jacob? That's where it came from? Okay. On Keith Olbermann's program on Current TV last night, was talking about the Federal Reserve bailout, and it's a perfect setup for the story that I wanted to share with you. Here's Alan Grayson first of all.
What they did is they took our money, the U.S. dollar, the fact that they control the currency, the fact that they have control of the money supply, and for the first time in history, they played favorites. They said, we'll give $100 billion to this institution, another $100 billion to this institution, and so on down the line, when you and I couldn't even come close to accessing those, that kind of money on those terms. They lent out this money at 0.01% interest. Go try to get a loan like that from your bank.
Yeah. Now, if you're a bank and you get money from the Fed at 0.01% interest, and then you loan that money to anybody else, including smaller banks, at, say, 1%, you're making an incredible profit. And Bloomberg actually sued the Fed. They found out that $7.7 trillion was given to the banks on these terms, and they found out who made how much money on it. These are the estimated profits. This, you can see this at Bloomberg.com. This is not, you know, like some kind of secret conspiracy. This is right there, right out. It's just that nobody's talking about it in the mainstream media because, you know, it's the 1% making their, you know, they're doing their little thing. Okay. How much money did each one of these companies make with their little piece of that $7.7 trillion that got passed out? If I said billion before, I meant trillion. $7.7 trillion. So they got the money. They loaned it out. They got, and then, you know, eventually they paid back much of it. Citigroup made $1.8 billion in profits. Did you make $1.8 billion in profits from the financial crash? Somehow I doubt it. Bank of America made $1.5 billion in profits. The Royal Bank of Scotland made $1.28 billion in profits from our Fed loaning the Royal Bank of Scotland money. Wells Fargo made $878 million. How many millions of dollars did you make from the crash? How many homeowners in America made anything from the crash? Wells Fargo made $878 million. Just on this sweet little deal. Barclays Bank, $640 million. J.P. Morgan Chase, it's Jamie Dimon's company, the organization that just, you know, gave a $4 million donation to the New York City Police Department to keep those nasty people away from Zuccotti Park. How much money did they make off that $7 trillion pass out of virtually free money that they could then recycle and make a profit on? Well, they made $457 million. Out of that $457.9 million, they took $4.6 million of it and gave it to the New York Police Department. That left them $453 million, if my math is right. That was J.P. Morgan Chase. Dexia. I don't even know what Dexia is. I'm guessing it's a German bank. Made $349 million. HBOS, $337 million. Credit Suisse Group. Ah, Swiss banks are making money off our... They made $287 million. Regions Financial, don't know what that is, $280 million. Deutsche Bank, biggest bank in Germany, I believe, $252.7 million. This is in profits. These are estimated income from the Fed loan program. Not the amount of money they took, but the profits they made as a result. This was not a matter of let's keep these banks from failing. This was let's help these guys make some profits so that they can pay their CEOs those millions of dollars that'll get recycled back into campaign contributions. You know how that works. UniCredit made $220 million. State Street Bank made $198 million. Fifth Third Bank Corp, as I recall, is a big bank based out of the Midwest, out of Ohio, made $185 million. Did you make $185 million on the banking crisis? Boy, there's money to be made in crises, right? This is why, you know, it's called disaster capitalism. $174 million made by BNP Paribas. I think they're Brazilian. Societe Generale, this is the French bank. They made $169 million. Well, anyhow, this is the first, like, maybe 10% of the list. Meanwhile, average Americans are screwed. Average Americans are having a horrible time. Average Americans, you know, the average income in the United States is in the neighborhood of $25,000. It's $26,261. That's the median yearly wage. Now, they like to say household wages are in the neighborhood of $54,000, about the same as they were when Reagan came into office. That's because in households, when Reagan came into office, on average, one point something person was working, and now it's like two point something people. Two people are working. They're working three jobs between the two of them. Three people are working. The kids have moved home. They're working. Everybody's working. Average household debt, $75,000 in the United States. So this is the mind-boggling piece of this entire thing. And last night I interviewed one of the world's top economists. I don't know how to describe him beyond that. He's got this incredible blog. His name is Steve Keen. He's an associate professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of a book called Debunking Economists, Economics, excuse me. His website, debtdeflation.com, is must-read reading. And here's what he had to say about, you know, in answer to my question. This is clip number 10, Jacob. Are we in a depression now?
With 17% of the workforce out of a job, you're talking one in six Americans. That's a depression in anybody's language statistically. And the cause of a depression is deleveraging. That's when people, the excessive level of private debt gets built up through a speculative bubble. People then unwind their debt positions either by deliberately reducing debt or by going bankrupt, of course. And that causes a chain reaction of aggregate demand being lower than aggregate supply. That's what really causes a depression. And that's happening quite dramatically now in America. You're deleveraging faster than any time since the Great Depression.
So we're deleveraging. In other words, people are shedding debt. They're either shedding debt through bankruptcy or by paying down their loans. But they're not buying things. It reduces what's called aggregate demand. Aggregate demand is demand in the marketplace. When we all know markets are driven by demand. Well, there's no demand. There's no market. And thus, you have a Great Depression. We are in a Great Depression right now. And we have a hell of a long way to go. Just consider the numbers of you know, what the debt ratio was like back in the 30s and 40s and what the debt ratio is like right now. Here again is Steve Keen from our conversation last night. This is clip 11.
If you take a look at the level of private debt to GDP, and that to me is by far the most important indicator of what's going on, that began back in 1945 in America at about 45% of GDP.
45%.
It peaked out at 301% in early 2009. It is now down to about 255%. So you've fallen about, say, 50% of GDP in terms of your debt levels.
Okay, just pause that right there, Jacob. So we've gone from, you know, the private debt, the debt out there in all the businesses and all the homeowners and everything like that in the 40s, when the Depression was over, arguably, of, you know, at the tail end of 45% of GDP. Now, GDP right now is around $15 trillion, so that would, in today, you know, if we were to extrapolate that out for today, it would be around $7 trillion. He said we hit the peak of over 300% in the last year of the Bush administration, because we had this huge bubble that Alan Greenspan was pumping up that was made possible by Phil Graham's passing a couple of laws back in the, or pushing through, you know, in, on behalf of his wife, Wendy, the on the board of directors of Enron. Phil Graham, now a lobbyist, I believe. With Graham, Leach, Bliley, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Pushing through this stuff to create this giant bubble. We hit over 300%. We're now down to 250%. Well, what that means is that, first of all, 50% of GDP has, like, evaporated in terms of, you know, cash. In other words, that's 50% of our GDP in aggregate demand. The demand is gone. That's enough to create a depression. But the big whoa to me is, he says, we still have 250% to go. Or really 200% to go to get us back down to 1945 levels. And what that means is we are in a Great Depression. It's going to get worse. So President Obama and the Democrats are trying to do something about this. And step one is, let's increase aggregate demand. In other words, let's put money in workers' pockets so they can buy things. Now, the Republicans won't let them do that by raising the minimum wage. They won't let them do that by extending or increasing unemployment benefits or raising Social Security payments or raising disability payments. All those things would increase aggregate demand. And so the Democrats are saying, well, let's do that by cutting payroll taxes by 2%. And so we don't take a whack out of the Social Security Trust Fund. We will hit millionaires with a 3.5% income tax increase after they make their first $1 million in 1 year. On their million and one-th dollar, million and first dollar, they're going to pay an extra 3.5%. And that will pay so that every family in America on average can have $1,500 extra dollars in their pocket. Tax cuts for the average people? A slight increase on people only making over $1 million. That's the 0.001% of Americans. Republicans are saying, oh no, that's our constituency, those multimillionaires. Are you kidding?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or the Republicans are saying, wait a minute, that might actually help the economy. Are you kidding? We can't have that in this election year. So it's actually incredible. I mean, when you look at all these things that are going on right now, in India, they're saying, no, wait a minute, we want a healthy retail sector. Please don't turn us into Walmart. And the government might fall over it. In Europe, it's a good poor choice of words to say they're concerned about a Holocaust. But they're talking about a disaster of biblical proportion, epic proportions, the euro crashing, basically. I mean, this could literally happen in the next week or two. And we're still at 200%, 250% of GDP in terms of just private debt in the United States that has to be deleveraged, that has to be paid back or bankrupted. Which says to me that housing prices are going to continue to fall for some significant period of time. And the uptick that we're seeing in the stock market right now, and in some places even in housing market prices, what looks like an economy, is simply reinflating the bubble. And, of course, both parties are going to do this. Everybody wants to get reelected. But the bottom line is that we are nowhere near out of the woods in this thing. We have so much farther to go because 30 years of Reaganomics have devastated the landscape of America. It's just very simple. And Alan Greenspan and his, you know, anything goes, leave it to the free market. It's just totally whacked us. On top of that, now you've got, you know, hey, let's turn America into a police state. You need to call your senator and tell them to you want the Udall Amendment to the Military Appropriations Bill. So, anyhow, Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Flo.
Hi. I got three things I want to talk about real quick. I'll
please pick
quick.
One, because I got a whole bunch of other callers here, and I got 6 minutes.
Okay. India.
Okay.
My daughter's husband works for IBM. It's okay for them to take IBM jobs to Mumbai.
Sure.
Most of the workers that my son-in-law works with, their jobs have gone to India.
Yeah. Oh, and hundreds of thousands of other American jobs. And thank you, Flo. And very interesting, over the weekend, I was reading a piece, I think it was in the Financial Times, might have been the New York Times, about how now that the Indian outsourcing companies are starting to outsource to the Philippines because they speak better English there. Bobby in Northwest Arkansas. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hey. Hey, Tom, not much. I'd like to say just a couple of things about money being speech. Now, I will start and say that I haven't been to movetoamend.org and haven't read it. But money being speech is definitely speech. By that, I want to say that it's an offer of performance, which is basically a contract. And if you look at the Federal Reserve note, the Federal Reserve note says that this is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
So you're asserting, Bobby, through this convoluted logic, that you believe that when the founders of this country said that free speech, Congress shall pass no laws abridging the right of free speech, that they meant Congress shall pass no laws preventing billionaires and corporations from spending unlimited amounts of money to get their message out.
That's kind of not what I'm getting at. I mean, we know that people are not. Our corporations are not people, but
let's just talk about billionaires. Somebody who's got $1 billion have more rights in the marketplace to get his message out than you or me?
No, well, I mean, it is a free country.
I mean, it's a free country in I mean, that's a nice cliche, but the fact of the matter is we're a country of rules. And if you're going to have a functioning democracy, just like if you're going to have a functioning football game, you have to have a decent set of rules. And by the way, have you noticed that under the new NBA rules, they're saying, you know, they're going socialist, just like the NFL, that they're saying, you know, okay, the team that does the worst gets the first picks, and they're doing salary caps and things. It's like everybody's trying to make the playing field more level, except Wall Street, and accept the banksters and accept the politicians, of course. So I'm sorry, I don't buy it. Money is not speech. Anthony in Detroit. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Good afternoon. Listen, on this money that the feds, the secret funding that the feds are loaning money out to other countries and the banks, that's besides the bailout. That's not the bailout money for the banks, right?
That's correct. It was $13 trillion in total. $7.7 trillion went just to banks. That's from the Fed that we didn't know a penny. We didn't know anything about. And then on top of that, there was the TARP, the $800 billion. That's not even $1 trillion. That's 0.8. That's 0.8 of $1 trillion. That's what went through Congress, you know, in the last year of the Bush administration that everybody was all screaming about and freaked out about, and that most people who watch Fox News think the Democrats did. In fact, it was Bush. And that at least went through a legislative process. But the $7.7 trillion to the banksters, the $13 trillion total overall, we didn't have any say in that. We had no knowledge of it.
When did that happen?
That happened in 2008, 2009.
So Obama was running for president then, right?
This was George Bush was president, and you know Obama was sworn in January 2009. And frankly, I doubt he even knew about this who knows when he, you know. It may be that he learned about it last week when we all learned about it.
Okay, so our legislators had to sign off on this also in some form of a bill?
No. No, the $7 trillion came out of the Fed. The Fed is not answerable to the government. The Fed does not need to answer to the president. It does not need to answer to Congress. The Fed is a private institution owned by its 10 or 12 regional banks, which then they themselves are owned by local banks. And it's a private institution. The only association with the government is that they print our money, they control our money supply, and a certain number of the Board of Governors and the chairman of the Fed are appointed by the president and have to be confirmed by the Senate.
Okay, this last one. You had Matt Taibbi on last week, and I think it was a Thursday or one, not Thursday, one day, a couple weeks ago maybe, and he was talking about the court, the federal courts was slapping the banksters on the...
Yeah, I was talking about that yesterday. Yesterday, a federal judge, the banksters were cutting a deal with the government to say, okay, we'll pay $25 billion in fines if you'll keep us from going to jail. And this federal judge came along and said, sorry, ain't going to happen.
Okay, don't that follow, do any of that follow, a couple weeks ago when he was on, he said Obama administration got to take ownership of this. They
yeah.
got prosecuting. So where can I get that information at? Because I went on your website looking for that.
On our website, I'm not sure where you'd find it. You know, I just go into the message boards and ask somebody, start a thread asking the question. It's very, very easy to Google this stuff, and it's out there, Anthony. Trust me, it's out there. Thank you for the call. Up next, should the military be able to lock up Americans without due process? Stay tuned. This is a BFD.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the last hour, we've been talking about how we are in a Great Depression and what the Indian government is trying to do to save their retail sector and what's going on with the euro and some pretty amazing stuff. We will circle back around to a little bit of that. And we also had a report from Eric Beiler live from Los Angeles on what's going on with the Occupy LA movement as well. I want to get back to that, but in the midst of this, this absolutely bizarre piece of legislation seems like it's heading for Congress right as we speak. Chris Anders is with us. Chris is the senior legislative counsel with the Washington Legislative Office, the ACLU. That's the DCACLU.org. And Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Chris. I assume legislative counsel means you're an attorney.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so you can speak of this with perhaps a little more authority than just the average political observer. Am I correct? And I first started getting emails about this a week or so ago, and people were saying, you know, Tom, if they decide that you're a terrorist or that they suspect that you're a terrorist, they can just lock you up and make you vanish for the rest of your life, and nobody will ever know. And I'm like, come on, you've been listening to Alex Jones, you know, it's. And then I read your piece over by the ACLU. I read it on Common Dreams. Senators demand the military lock up American citizens in a battlefield they define as being right outside your window, and said to myself, holy cow, these people were not hysterics. And so let me just ask you, is this true?
It is, and it's amazing. You would think that this is some huge conspiracy theory generated kind of thing, but this is for real, and this is being debated literally right now. Actually, the senators just left for a lunch break, but it was debated this morning on the Senate floor. It's going to get a vote at about 2:15, somewhere between 2:15 and 2:30. So a lot of senators are still making up their mind. Most of them had not seen this language and hadn't looked at it till just a few days ago. So most of them are still making up their mind literally right now. So it's a good time for people to hear from constituents. But the other thing too is that this is so extreme that it does involve American citizens. It does involve people who could be picked up even in the United States itself and be put into military prisons, potentially for the rest of their lives, without ever being charged with a crime. And one of the most amazing exchanges this morning on the Senate floor was Senator Rand Paul from Tea Party Republican from Kentucky, who actually is opposing these provisions, which is good for him.
Yeah.
He asked Senator McCain, who's supporting them, he said, well, isn't it true that American citizens could be picked up by the military, not charged with any crime, and sent to Guantanamo? And John McCain didn't deny it. Instead, he started talking about, well, how American citizens, if they're a threat to their country, have put themselves in the camp of being enemy belligerents and should be treated that way.
Now, we used to have a law that was passed during Reconstruction in the 1870s, as I recall, maybe late 1860s, yep. Posse Comitatus, which said that, you know, we just suffered a horrible civil war. Never again will federal military forces have the legal authority to turn their guns on American citizens on American soil. That was repealed during the Bush administration in one of these military appropriations bills. We no longer have Posse Comitatus. So the military...
Actually, that was then restored later. So it was. So it's still good law. It was for about a year, the Posse Comitatus Act was riddled with loopholes. But then a year later, Congress came to its senses, realized what it had done, and put the pieces back together.
Well, you know, Baruch Hashem for that. But thank God for that. But then doesn't this contradict that?
It does, and that's one of the other concerns we have, is that this law has been around for about 140 years that basically said that the military cannot be used for law enforcement within the United States. But here's the problem, is that a lot of people have counted on that protection almost like it's part of the Constitution, but it's not. And instead,
it's just a law.
It's a statute, and so it's only as good as the commitment of every future Congress and every future president to uphold it and not to carve exceptions to it.
Right.
So it's not, it's only, the protection is only as good as this Congress's commitment to it. And
Or the executive branch could just choose not to enforce it the way that Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and its followers back in 1982. I mean, it's still on the books.
And I think, you know, but the concern we have here is that this legislation is being rushed through the Senate,
right.
It's already, there's a different version of this already passed the House back in May.
With this nasty language in it?
Well, it's actually in some ways worse. It doesn't have all these detention provisions in, but on the House side, the Defense Authorization Bill has in it essentially a worldwide declaration of war. So it's basically a worldwide authorization for the president, this president, any future president, to use military force anywhere where a terrorism suspect.
So here we are, 1984, perpetual peace by virtue of perpetual war. First of all, I understand that Senator Udall has proposed an amendment to strip out the awful language on that.
Yeah.
And everybody should be callcongress.org has phone numbers that you can use to call Congress. And, you know, it's, you know, just, you should be calling Congress now and say, support Senator Udall's, you know, what do you call it, amendment.
Yep.
But just tell them no. But this, it's like, what can we do? I mean, you know, where do we go with this? This is going to have to go back to a joint House Senate Conference Committee, right? Because
we're just going to start almost right away. I mean, they're going to try to jam this through within the next 2 weeks.
And then the president has to sign it. And so there's still two more points of pressure for those of us who are genuinely horrified by this.
Yes. And the good, you know, the good thing with the president is that the White House has threatened to veto it. The Director of National Intelligence, the Secretary of Defense, and the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, have all come out against these provisions.
Wow.
But the problem is that this is something that is being pushed by Senator Levin, a Democrat from Michigan, these bad provisions, and John McCain. And they're pulling out all the stops.
I'm totally baffled by this, Chris. You know, John McCain was the guy who said torture is wrong. He'd been there and traditionally had been a little libertarian-ish. And Carl Levin, you know, I mean, I used to live in Michigan. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I've kept track of Carl Levin's career over the years. He's a pretty good guy. What are these people thinking?
He is. I think it became, it became something that they felt like there became a kind of a frenzy on the Armed Services Committee this late spring to do something about detention, and they started drafting, and it seems like they just kind of got carried away. And this is part of what happens when you hide the ball on the American public, because there wasn't a single hearing on this and it was a closed markup, which means which means nobody saw this language until it was a done deal.
Wow.
And if this thing had, you know, seen the light of day, and there had been hearings on it, and people had an opportunity to look at it, people like you and your listeners had an opportunity to see it, then we wouldn't be in this mess we are right now on the Senate floor. People would have weighed in earlier and said no, you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
But now they've dug in their heels on this, and it's kind of come hell or high water. They're going to try to get this through the Senate. Your listeners, though, really should be calling, because within
right.
the next hour, about an hour from now, the Senate's going to be voting, and lots of senators have not made up their minds yet.
Right, and even if this vote goes wrong today, if somebody calls several hours from now or calls tomorrow, there will
right.
have to be another vote, because there's going to be a conference committee, because the House and Senate
That's
legislation
right.
is not identical.
Yeah,
so,
the message is to vote yes on the Udall Amendment.
Yes, vote yes on the Udall Amendment. Strip out the craziness from the Military Appropriations Bill, the Defense Appropriations Bill. Chris Anders, DCUCLA.org, the website, the UCLA.
DCACLU. www.aclu.org.
ACLU,
this is
you.
The Tom Hartman Program.
I'm sorry about that, Chris. Thank you very much for being with
us. Okay, great. Thank you.
We can bomb the world to pieces, yeah. But we can't bomb it into peace.
Okay, just to get it out of the way, I suppose, the obligatory Herman Cain news. This guy is not running for president. He was never running for president. We've known this all along. He's on a book tour. And now he's been accused of having sex with more people than most men have in their entire life. And, you know, is it going to take him down? No, of course he's still on book tour. Come on, give me a break. This is not serious. He is not serious. The Republican Party is not serious, for goodness sakes. I mean, here you have, right now, you have the president and the Democrats saying, okay, we're in this massive deleveraging right now. We're in this massive unwinding of unsustainable consumer debt. Our consumer debt in the United States, our private debt in the United States is over 250% of GDP. In 1945, it was about 50% of GDP. At its peak, it was at 309% of GDP, as I recall from the clip that we played from Steve Keen earlier. And so it's dropped by 50% of GDP, but it's still 250% of GDP. So there's this enormous debt out there that we've got to pay off. In other words, we're in the middle of a Great Depression. One of the things I was saying in the last hour, one of the things that just was a huge forehead slap for me that I never realized until just recently, is that during the last Great Depression, nobody called it a depression. You don't realize it until you look back on it. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt referred to it as this economic crisis, or these challenging times, or these difficult times, or the current crisis. You've heard those clips on this show over and over and over again. He never refers to the depression. People don't realize that they're in it when they're in it. We're in it. Home prices right now are down 3.9% from where they were a year ago in the United States. That's called deflation. 22% of all American homeowners are upside down on their mortgage. That is deflationary. That in deflation is what a depression is all about. So it's like, some really, really strange stuff coming down the road here. Meanwhile, Congress wants to say, the entire world is a battlefield. We're in a perpetual war, and the military can come knocking on your door. Take you away, put you in Guantanamo, and we'll never hear from you again. If they don't like what you're up to, all they have to do is invoke the magic word, terrorist. I think this guy's a terrorist. And guess what? If you look at the Patriot Act, it defines terrorism fairly broadly. Terrorism includes acts of economic sabotage. According to the Patriot Act, if you stand out in front of a McDonald's with a sign that says, Eating meat is, will clog your arteries and kill you. And McDonald's can demonstrate that it causes people to not eat there. You could technically be charged with an act of terrorism because you've interfered with commerce. Now, that was actually written into the law with the intent of stopping the animal rights folks, the so-called eco-terrorist folks, and the anti-fur people. But, like, you know, I mean, it's like the road to hell is paved with good, not that those are necessarily good intentions. But we are setting this thing up. I mean, you know, you think, oh, well, Barack Obama's a good guy. He'd never do that. Eh, maybe not. Maybe he is. I don't know. But I sure know what George W. Bush would have done if he could. And, in fact, he did. I mean, look at the people. They had a bumper sticker on their car that said, get out of Iraq, and they tried to go to a Bush rally, and they were these three young people. We had them on our program. This was back 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And they were arrested and hauled out of a public event in a stadium. Oh, we saw the bumper sticker on your car. We can't have you here. I mean, at what point do you start using the phrase police state? And I'm telling you, there's a whole generation of young people right now who are realizing that they are coming of age in a depression, that they are confronting something that looks like a police state. And what they haven't yet figured out, although it's quickly dawning on them, is that this is a depression brought to you by 30 years of libertarian economics. Alan Greenspan saying, well, you know, these are free markets. These are people, you know, consenting adults having contractual agreements with each other, and we need to get as much government regulation out of the way as possible. So let's, and we'll make money cheap. And we had this enormous bubble. And Ronald Reagan saying, hey, you know, when Republicans are in office, we need to borrow like crazy, put it on the national credit card, make it look like good times, inflate the economy like nuts. And then we'll take credit for the good economy. And then when a Democrat comes into office, starts screaming and yelling about the debt that the Republicans ran up so that the Democrat can't continue spending, so the bubble will burst. And the bad times will roll. And you know, Obama's trying to reinflate the bubble a little bit, which I'm very ambivalent about. But nonetheless, he's trying to do this with this payroll tax cut. And saying, and, you know, so that we don't hurt Social Security, we'll pay for it by a 3.5% tax on people's income after their first $1 million a year. $3.50 on every $100 after your first $1 million a year. And the Republicans are saying, no way. Are you kidding? People who make more than $1 million a year, those are our supporters.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, Mayor Cory Booker from Newark, New Jersey, and your call. 27 minutes past the hour. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Anand in Oakland. Mayor Booker will be with us in a few moments. Anand in Oakland, thank you for calling and for listening on Green 960. Hey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, about Walmart and IKEA getting into India. Well, I'm from India. I've been here for 28 years, and seeing what's happening in India, it's scary. I think Walmart and IKEA will succeed despite the opposition, and eventually India will fall in the trap.
Yeah, now let me just, for people who don't know what you're talking about, Anand, let me just give a little bit of a setup. Front page of today's Financial Times, which I'm holding up here for the camera, Singh, who is the prime minister, faces right. backlash against opening up India's retail sector. Fear over jobs spark parliamentary revolt. Right now, about 95% of the entire retail sector in India is small mom-and-pop shops, like it was in the United States before Ronald Reagan came along and stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. And so, you know, every town looks different. Every mall has small shops. People pass businesses down from generation to generation. And if a foreign company wants to come in, they have to have a 51% partner, even Walmart. And now they're saying, well, let's change that. Let's just let foreign companies come in, IKEA, Walmart, whatever, and let them do whatever they want. And the people of India are going, whoa, no, you don't. And but the transnational corporations want to get their way. And you're saying, Anand, as an Indian or as a person who is from India, I don't know what your citizenship is now, but
I'm a U.S. citizen
okay,
now, but
so
I'm from India originally.
Yeah, that and you're quite familiar with India, that you think that the transnational corporations are gonna win and Singh is going to lose? Or
I think they will, because here's what it is, Tom. Out of the over a billion population, because of the current economic growth and the opportunities they have, a good 300 million or so portion is middle class. Middle class is doing extremely well.
Yeah.
And that middle class loves Walmart. That middle class loves IKEA, and they love McDonald's and Coke. So all these foreign industries and multinational corporations eventually find roots. I mean, Coca-Cola bought over the local bottling companies and got them out of business. Some of the popular names, they came on their own name, under
yeah.
their own name. So that's what's happening. It's an unfortunate thing, but the opposition currently, you will see that as a political theater, and this is strictly my opinion. I'm not expert or pundit in any of these issues.
Yeah.
It's just a layman's view that I think this will go on in the political theater for a while. It will subside. The opposition will be bought over. Eventually, Walmart and IKEA will find its route there.
Yeah. And the transnationals will own the world or they will own India as they own so much of the rest of the world.
And the middle class, which is seeing its growth and prosperity right now, and they're sort of blinded by it, they won't notice it, but their children will feel the consequences about 15, 20, 30 years down the road.
Yeah, just as those of us back in the 80s when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and we had this explosion of mergers and acquisitions.
Down, and currently the American middle class is hurting.
Yep.
It's exactly going to hurt them the same way.
Yep.
And my solution to all that is simple. We can fight multinational corporations on that level, but I refuse as much as possible. Now, it's impossible to not shop multinational.
Yeah.
Wherever possible, I avoid multinationals.
Absolutely. And this is something that more and more people are doing. And thank you, Anand, for the call. And I agree with you. Boycott in principle is a great idea. But really what we need to do, and every country needs to be doing, is having basically protectionist legislation, laws that protect businesses within their countries. And as India has and is about to change, and as the United States had and was suspended by Reagan in the early 80s. Reginald in Houston, Texas. Hey, Reginald, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you know what's on my mind, man. You know, we talking about what's trying to Senate bill. This is empire over morality. You have this is almost a portion of what we're going through is almost like martial law. What happened on the Patriot Act on September 11th, September 14th, you know, when only Barbara Lee stood up for that Patriot Act.
Yes,
that
was she was the sole vote against it.
Sole
God bless
that.
Her.
And they made that mistake then, and if they make the same mistake again, you know, that's deception. You know, and that for them to say that they didn't know anything about it and take away the civil liberties, deja vu. And the words say the people perish for lack of knowledge. Now we know, you know, and just like we had no accountability for Iraq and Great Britain had hearings, maybe we should be some hearings and some oversight. Where's Eric Holder? You know, isn't that an act of terrorism? And isn't that weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
You know,
well, there's a whole lot of, thank you, Reginald. Well said. And there's a whole lot of questions associated with the original Patriot Act. For example, the Patriot Act had to get out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Pat Leahy was the head of that committee. He was the senator in charge. The Democrats controlled the Senate at that time because Jim Jeffords, the Republican from Vermont, had just flipped to becoming an independent. This was in 2001. And the Democrats held the Senate by one vote. And so the Democratic head of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, was the guy that the Patriot Act had to get passed to get out of committee to get to the floor. And he was very reluctant. And then once it got past Pat Leahy, it had to go to the Senate Majority Leader, who would bring it up for a vote. That was Tom Daschle. Okay? Remember these names? Pat Leahy, the senator, Democratic senator from Vermont. Tom Daschle, Democratic senator from one of the Dakotas. I think it's North Dakota. And who were the only, and they were inclined not to do it. And as the debate was happening about whether or not the Patriot Act should get out of committee and come to the floor for a vote, who were the only two people in Washington, D.C. who got anthrax in the mail? Go back and look it up. Well, I'll tell you, it was Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. Now, I think you know that I'm not, you know, a fan of totally whacked out conspiracy theories, although I suppose I have a few of my own, you know, the robotic pigeons are here. But that's just like too much. And why aren't we still don't know where that anthrax came from. And the guy who committed suicide, who they said, oh, he's the one who did it. Now they've come out, and again, this is just a little story in the New York Times. Now they come out and say, no, no, it couldn't have been him. I would love to see an investigation on this one. Shahid, in New York City. Oh. Hey, what's up?
Oh, how you doing, Tom? I'm a first-time caller, and I just want to say thanks for taking my call. This is about Herman Cain. Mm-hmm. This is what I want to know. If you don't mind me asking, didn't it come out that he's a reverend or a pastor of a church or something to that effect? And if in fact that's a fact,
I don't think so. He was on the Federal Reserve Board in Kansas City. He was a businessman. You know, he worked for I think it was Pepsi when they owned Godfather's Pizza, and then he took that company private. You know, he has a pretty impressive CV. But I don't think minister is part of it. And he's on a book tour right now. And this is what I've been saying all along, is him and Newt Gingrich are on a book tour. And Michelle Bachmann is just trying to raise enough money that she can, you know, successfully run to reestablish her campaign. I don't think most of these people are seriously running for president. So
I agree.
And I'm guessing that probably Herman Cain has hit so many bookstores now and sold so many books that he's going to pull the plug on his so-called campaign. So we'll see. Shahid, thank you very much for the call. It's good to hear from you. Ariel in Colton, California. Got to push the button right the right way. Ariel, what's up?
Thanks for pushing that button.
My pleasure.
Anyway, I had two comments I wanted to make about some statements last week. One was I believe somebody there, you maybe said that George Washington was an atheist. Well, there's a thing on the internet, religious quotes of the United States presidents,
mm-hmm.
and George Washington in particular, along with some of the others, had a deep reverence for God and had a lot of prayers implemented in a lot of his meetings and stuff. And also, the Muslim Brotherhood was asked if anybody knew anything about them, and then somebody told you that they're a group of kind of old, inefficient guys hanging around or something.
Yep.
But actually, just so you and the audience will know, they're a vital force in the radical.
They are increasingly a major political party, and they used
and
to be
against Israel and the United States. So, they're not participating.
You know, that's
so
like saying the Democratic Party is something. Ariel, you're taking these simplistic talking points from Fox News and Glenn Beck, and they're not true.
No, I'm not.
And in particular, the stuff about George Washington is not true. Yes, of course, he signed some things that had God on it. But first of all, you got David Barton out there who's actually making up quotes from these people. I would suggest that you...
No, he was Christian. He was a very Christian man.
He was not, and he would never admit
it. Yes, he was. Honest to goodness.
I've got a minute and a half to go to.
Look it up on their own. They'll see his quotes and stuff. And I'm not trying to argue with anybody.
No,
what I know from
Thomas Jefferson, in his autobiography and in one of his letters to Adams, he was talking about how George Washington was either a deist or atheist. And he talked about how the churches tried to get him to answer the question about whether or not he was a Christian. And Jefferson said, and you can Google this, Jefferson said, and the old fox succeeded in never telling them, never addressing the issue.
Because he didn't want them to think he was one particular thing.
No, because most of those guys back then were deists or atheists or something very close to it. Jefferson was a deist. I mean, they believed in something out there, but they were not Christians. And Patrick Henry was the Christian. I mean, if you want a Christian, quote Patrick Henry. He was full bore out there, totally, you know, Bible-thumping Christian. Thank you, Ariel.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I can see I'm going to have to share some Jefferson quotes with you in the next hour. Up next, Talk Radio News. We'll be right back. It's Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. However, does not lead to stiff thinking. And don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Uh-oh. Ellen Ratner is with us. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman.
That's right.
And what a cool new book you've got.
Well, thank you. Okay.
So what's going on in the world?
The House. They are going to be having several votes today, mainly beginning around 6:30 in the evening. Immigration policy is one of them. They want to end a cap on those technical visas, also want to end a cap on family immigrant visa, but not to change the overall amount of immigrants that they will allow in the United States.
Okay.
So those particular caps would go, but not the total amount.
So what does that mean?
Kind of visas would go. I mean, other people who get normal other visas would not get them as easily.
So basically, wealthy people or well-educated people can more easily get into the United States.
Well-educated people or family members.
Right. But yes. But just average people or refugees going to have a harder time.
I think so. And I personally have experience with the refugee status from South Sudan.
Yeah,
not easy.
I would say that's probably going to be
right at
the top of the list of not easy to get in.
I already had a problem, you know. And
with this young blinded
man.
It
cost me $11,000 and the head of the Africa Committee.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, very nice. Amazing. Okay. Bankruptcy protections is another bill that's going to come up for National Guard and people who have gone, National Guard and people who have been through Iraq and Afghanistan as soldiers. The Senate is going to be taking a look at what about putting these people, Senator Udall, I believe Udall of Colorado, wants to get rid of having people go directly to military.
Right. We just had Chris Anders from the ACLU here in D.C. on
right.
about this, and this is absolutely bizarre.
It's bizarre, but it looks like the Senate will vote it down.
They will.
Oh,
okay.
Please. In this day and age.
This is a military appropriations bill. I mean, the Senate doesn't vote down military appropriations bills.
But this is an amendment.
So it's an amendment. So they're going to vote down the Udall amendment that neutralizes this?
I think so, yes.
So in other words, this awful piece of legislation is going to pass?
I think so.
Well, you know, there's still two more chances. It's going to have to be reconciled with the House, so there's going to be another vote, and the president can veto it. And he's on record as saying he will veto it.
Right. Well, look like, by the way, yes, he is on record of saying he will veto that because he doesn't want to tie the hands of the U.S., and he's right. Also looks like there's going to be sanctions that will get through on Iran's central bank. And, by the way, the White House also issued today something about, the British embassy was stormed in Iran, and the White House has clearly condemned it.
Shades of the Carter administration.
Yes. Right.
How's this playing out? Did the British have the embassy back yet?
No, I don't think they did. Was anyone
taken hostage?
No one was taken hostage. No one was killed at this point. But, of course, they're not sure. But these students
right.
Stormed them.
Right. Deja vu all over.
The vice president, on his way to Turkey and Greece, stopped by in Baghdad today. This is his eighth visit, or is it his ninth visit? Let me just see this. His eighth or ninth visit it's his eighth trip to Iraq. And, of course, we are closing out of Iraq with military personnel. We'll have at least 15,000 or 16,000 non-military contractors there.
Very interesting.
So
we stay even though we don't stay.
Well, we don't have to. We can say we're not. there as
right.
military, right? The Secretary Clinton is going to be visiting Miramar. That is the 50th time. Well, it is. There's been no American visiting, no Secretary of State visiting.
Myanmar, you mean Burma?
Burma. Yes. She's going to be going for 2 days, I think Thursday and Friday this week. Everybody and their brother is issuing statements about the prisoners of conscience. They think there's as many as 1,000 prisoners of conscience. As you know, they let out people from there, some prisoners, yeah. but they're saying,
Aung Susie Khan.
That's right.
I might mispronounce it.
Aung Suu Kyi.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. So she's going. She's getting a lot of heat from some of the non-government organizations who are concerned about human rights.
Oh, but interesting. By legitimizing the government
no
by
Secretary of State
them.
Has been there for 50 years.
Wow.
I hear they have great rubies, though.
Yeah. yeah.
It looks
that region, actually,
yes.
by Thailand.
It looks like the payroll tax vote is going to come in several votes, but the first one is going to be to add a tax surcharge for people making $1 million more, over 3.25%, I think. Mm-hmm. However, the Republicans are expected to vote that down, and this is the idea of if you're going to give a payroll decrease, you have to pay for it in some way. So why not have the Republicans, why not the Republicans and Democrats coming up with the idea of having people who make $1 million or more a year pay for it so people can get that 2% payroll decrease? No, the Republicans, not one is expected to vote for it.
In the House?
In the Senate.
In the Senate. Wow. So this is a tax cut that's going to average $1,000 to $1,500 per average working American
family. That's right.
Family. This is people who all...
The 99%.
100% of them make less than $187,000 a year, which
right.
would be even the 96%
right.
probably. And those people will get a tax cut. People earning over $1 million a year, the 0.001%, they will see a 3.6% tax increase on their million and first dollar, and the Republicans are going to vote against this.
And they want to do 3.5% surtax on income above $1 million.
Right, and the Republicans think they're going to run on this in 2012?
We saved the billionaires
while we screwed
the middle
class.
It's unbelievable because the polling has shown they're not going to win on this.
It's incredible.
And speaking of not winning, Mr. Kaine is going to assess his campaign this
yeah.
point.
Well, I think he's hit enough bookstores, because I've been saying all along he's not running for president. He's on book tour.
Right.
And he's hit all the bookstores there are, and he's probably got his speaking fees, his inspirational speaking gig, which is how he makes his living these days. He's probably got his speaking fee up, from $5,000 a whack to $50,000 a whack. Maybe it'll drop now down to 20. But people will still come for the spectacle.
Oh, of course they'll come.
And to see who's with it.
And he can write a new book, right?
right.
Exactly,
yes.
exactly.
It's, I think he has now officially denied having sex with more women than most men have actually had sex with
exactly,
in their lives.
Exactly. Okay.
Last 10 seconds.
The House wants to expedite screening for the military at airports so they don't have to go through those big long lines.
So just House members?
No.
Oh, for everybody.
For military.
For the military.
Right.
Oh, interesting. I think we're fetishizing the military here. Helen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, her new book.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And at the very end of the last hour, I muttered an obscenity in a quick comment to Ellen. And if it got, we grabbed it and it didn't go out on the air. If it did, I wanted to apologize. And speaking of such things... We had a caller in the last hour who was like, Tom, I've been reading on the internet and George Washington was a Christian. Okay. I promised you I would respond. And in fact, this is because those who control history control the future. It's more than just a cliche or a maxim. If you can rewrite the stories of the past, you can influence the future. And there is a very, very aggressive effort going on by people like David Barton, who is the, quote, historian, although he's not a historian, that Glenn Beck always had on his show, who literally makes up quotes for the founders, including quotes by George Washington, literally makes them up out of whole cloth, and they have appeared in textbooks. I mean, there's a whole industry now of going back and finding David Barton quotes and stripping them out. So let's look at some actual quotes. And some of the things, you know, what the founders actually believed about religion in America and its role in America. And what kind of nation this was. And first of all, keep in mind, this was the generation, the founding generation, that didn't have the direct memory of, but had the near memory of the Salem witch trials. It's like, the way that we have the memory of the Great Depression. It was our grandparents or our parents or our great-grandparents. But, you know, it was close by. Ben Franklin fled Boston because Massachusetts was the one state that was basically run by the Puritans and the Pilgrims who had come from England after they'd gotten kicked out, you know, the whole Cromwell thing, after they got kicked out of England because they tried to take over the country. They actually did take over the country for, what was it, 6 or 7 years? And then the people said, get rid of these religious crazies. I mean, they banned music and dancing. They said, get rid of these people. Bring back the king. And we don't like kings, but bring back the king. And that was back in the 16-somethings. So anyhow, they had this memory of this. Ben Franklin left Boston when he was a teenager because he wanted to get away from it. He went to Philadelphia, a very secular city. And he wrote in his autobiography, I have found the Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies. Now, I'm not saying this to trash Christianity. I call myself a Christian. I'm saying this to let us establish the record. And there's important reasons for this. The most important one, I think, is that we have religious institutions in this country. They are buying up radio and television stations across the country like there's no tomorrow, and they're doing it with your and my tax dollars. They're building schools with your and my tax dollars. They're making fortunes. You got people like Pat Robertson, who's worth $1 billion with a B, and he made it all tax-free because he called himself religious. Great business if you can be in it. You got an entire broadcasting network out there, right-wing broadcasting network running 24/7, running some really incredibly toxic right-wing programming, and it's paid for by their Bible publishing division. Which may be for profit. I don't know. But that's the pervasive influence of religion. So anyhow, to George Washington, February 1st, 1799, you can look it up. Thomas Jefferson wrote in his diary, in his personal diary, February 1st, 1799, quote, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from government, which had, by the way, just happened to, you know, years earlier, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, and by the way, keep in mind, Thomas Jefferson was the Secretary of State for George Washington, so he was like in the cabinet, he kind of knew what was going on. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence. When the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought that they should pen their address in a way so as to force him at length to declare publicly whether or not he was a Christian. They did so. In other words, they wrote this letter to force Washington to say whether or not he was a Christian. However, Jefferson wrote in his diary, February 1, 1799, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that, which he passed over without notice. Now, Jefferson continued in his personal diary. He said, Washington never did say a word on the subject of Christianity in any of his public papers, except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of the, quote, benign influence of the Christian religion, end quote. I know that Governor Morris, who was another one of the politicians of the day and one of the founders, who pretended to be in his secrets, in other words, who is a confidant of Washington's, and believed himself to be so, has often told me, this is Thomas Jefferson writing in his diary, has often told me that General Washington believed no more of that fundamentalist Christian system than he himself did. In fact, George Washington supervised the language of the treaty with Tripoli. which starts out, as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, but it gets better. James Madison, February 21st, 1811, his first veto. He is the fourth president of the United States. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison. James Madison, his first veto was a veto to cancel payments to churches to care for the poor. Because since the Washington administration, the government itself had been providing poor houses. Why did he not want churches to? Because he said, and I'm reading from his veto letter, it would be a precedent for giving to religious societies to carry into effect a public and civil duty. Now, Madison was actually a religious guy. He was, I believe he was Presbyterian, might have been Episcopal. But he considered himself a Christian. He did not want the churches getting government money because he thought it would corrupt them. Now, this is my favorite one, this famous quote from Thomas Jefferson. It's in the Jefferson Memorial here in Washington, D.C. It says, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. Kind of sounds like, you know, he's into God, right? That's the quote that everybody quotes. Let me give it to you in context. It's from a letter that he wrote to Benjamin Rush, one of his very best friends. He was a physician. And he was also one of the founders, and he was a deist and a Unitarian. And he said, dear sir, and this was a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote just before the election of 1800. He was running for president of the United States 3 months before the election. He writes this letter to Benjamin Rush. And it was very personal, very private. In fact, at the end of the letter, he talks that, please do not expose this. He said, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, in other words, the angry priests who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, he's talking about the First Amendment, which while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes his own form to be the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country, he's talking about the probability that he will be elected president. Right, this is 3 months before the election. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly. For I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough, too, in their opinion. Interesting, when you put things in context, how they sometimes reverse.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. I'm going to get back to contemporary politics up next. Cheesy news alert. And where the Senate is going with all this stuff. Stick around.
That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion. Trying to keep up you.
Jacob is the master of the right bumper. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Our cheesy news alert, courtesy of Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, and a new poll of likely GOP voters. 28% think Herman Cain had an extramarital affair, 28% do not think he had an affair, and 44% are having an affair with Herman Cain right now. Of the voters currently having sex with Mr. Cain, 52% called the relationship special, 38% called it inappropriate, and 10% agreed with the statement, I know I am Herman's soulmate and someday we'll be together. According to Davis Logsdon, who conducted the poll for the University of Minnesota's Opinion Research Institute, the numbers could spell trouble for the former pizza executive. Said Professor Logsdon, there is no precedent for a successful White House run by a man with over 10 million exes. In an interview with CNN's Wolf Blitzer today, Mr. Cain seemed to brush off the latest developments, saying, now you know why I got your name wrong, Blitz. I have a lot of names to keep straight in my head. Mr. Cain added, my message to the American people remains the same, and that message is, I told you not to call me here. Oh, I shouldn't laugh. It's the foibles of human tragedy and human weakness. Anyhow, Jim in Harrisville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'm just curious as to what you think about the 99 percenters, and if you think there will actually be an armed revolution in our country in the future, as in what's happened in the past history of our country.
Well, our country was founded in an armed revolution, and then we had an insurrection, the Civil War, and so two on our soil very, very bloody episodes. I don't expect that to happen again. I hope that doesn't happen again. I think that, we saw in the 1960s and early 70s the, riots in some of our cities that were coming out of a time after the Arab oil boycott that, the price of oil spiked up and inflation went nuts and unemployment got really bad. The economy got bad. And as much as I hate to say it, it wouldn't shock me to see that kind of thing that we're seeing right now in the UK and in Greece and in Italy and in Spain, those kinds of things happening in the United States. But I don't think that that's going to be the prime motivating force. I don't think that that's going to be driving it any more than Martin Luther King and SNCC and all that were driving those riots. They weren't. And thank you, Jim, for the call. They were arguably happening at relatively the same time. But it does concern me. When I am convinced that, and I think the numbers absolutely irrefutably bear this out, and we're going to try and get a few more experts on the program to just backstop this, that we are in a Great Depression and it's going to get worse. And when it gets worse, how are people going to respond? And I think the Occupy Wall Street movement, this is what I like about the Occupy Wall Street, and the reason why it gives me hope, whereas the Tea Party movement frightened me, frankly. The Tea Party movement was authoritarian, top-down, paid for by billionaires, and was very much, yes, sir. And the Occupy Wall Street movement is saying, no, we're not buying into the authority figures, and, we're not going to go along with that stuff. And we know that it's the banksters. And, enough already. Let's have a country that works for the rest of us. And that's a very hopeful message. That's not the message you were hearing in the 1930s. In Europe, in Germany, Italy, and Spain. There the message was, go with the authoritarians, and you saw how that played out. Whereas in the United States in the 1930s, thank goodness Franklin Roosevelt was president. So we'll see how this plays out. Ryan, listening on XM Radio in Michigan. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
How are you doing, Tom?
Great, what's up?
I called two radio shows, right-wing radio shows today, both Wilkow and Gibson, to talk about Senator Brownback's apparent inability to take criticism from a college student.
Yeah.
Both times I was cut off. No, wait. The Wilkow cut me off, didn't even let me finish my comment. Gibson wouldn't put me on the air. And basically this just proves my point about right-wing talk show hosts. They have to dictate what's heard and what's not heard. And it's like dealing with children.
Yeah, well, the one thing that I find really interesting about it all, Ryan, is that there used to be this, I'm forgetting his name now, it's been a couple of years, we had him on our show once, this guy who was, successful in getting past Rush Limbaugh's call screeners to actually challenge him about economics on the air, and he was running this kind of little online school about how to lie to the call screeners for the right-wing talk show hosts so that you could get on and speak truth to them, and it's so funny because we have a special phone number, 866-745-CONS, C-O-N-S. And if somebody calls up and says that they're a conservative or they want to argue with me or they want to dispute what I'm saying, they go first. And it's like, I welcome debate. I love debate. I love talking to these guys. And, I really think that the only, and thank you for the call, I really think that the only way that these guys can hold their message together, since so much of it is based on lies fundamentally, is by kicking out people who, not allowing a free discussion. Bill in Mendocino City, California. Bill, we got a minute to the break. Quick one.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Okay, so how do we relate what's happening with the crash of the euro to the bill in front of the Senate today? Easy. Who's the new prime minister of Greece, of interim prime minister?
Right, he's
former
VP of the Central Bank.
Who's the new prime minister of Italy? A former banker. Who's the new head of the IMF? A former Goldman Sachs banker. And then over here, who's the people that are pushing this domestic terrorism thing? Former bankers and Peter King looking out for the things of the banks. Here's what's going on. there is a major awakening happening around the planet. And do you think the oligarchs are going to sit back and let this happen? No. They are going to exert every single little button they can push to put the pressure on the people to keep the established order going.
Bill, I do not disagree with you. And it goes beyond just the banksters, because if you look at the Chamber of Commerce, if you look at the Council of 100, if you look at these groups of basically business groups, you find that it's the big transnational corporations who in many cases are banks, like General Motors or GE.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, they both have banking divisions and they got TARP money. Coming up next, the good, bad, and the very, very ugly. And you're... Yeah, but it's the good, the bad, and the very, very spotogenously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Norm Stamper. As the former police chief in Seattle, Stamper has a perspective we all should listen to when it comes to the crackdown on Occupy Wall Street. Referring to the police using chemical weapons against peaceful patriots, Stamper said, quote, "It is clearly an abuse of tear gas when it is used against passive demonstrators who are taking part in acts of civil disobedience, which are such a rich part of our democracy. We should recognize that we are a tool of community in the advancement of public safety and good. Police today have lost sight of their purpose," end quote. They have. And we need more cops like Norm Stamper to help them realize it. The bad, Steve Ducey. GOP TV's Fox and Friends was at it again this morning, rejoicing over Congressman Barney Frank's decision to retire next year. And Ducey did a little rewriting of history, too, trying to pin the blame of the 2008 financial crisis, the meltdown, on, you guessed it, Barney Frank. Here it is.
If you had to put one face to the catastrophe that was 2008, it would probably be Barney Frank.
Right. Not Wall Street, not Lloyd Blankfein, not George W. Bush, not Hank Paulson, but Barney Frank? Hear that, Occupy Wall Street? You got the wrong guys. Time to occupy Barney Frank's house. Another case of GOP TV's rewrite of the history of how the financial crisis started. They report you're misled. And the very, very ugly, the Scottsdale Gun Club. What better way to get in the Christmas spirit than to let children pose for pictures with Santa Claus and assault rifles? That's right. In what the Scottsdale Gun Club is calling a family event called Santa and the Machine Guns, kids get to play with actual pistols, shotguns, and rifles that are often bigger than they are before telling Santa what they want for Christmas. The gun club even encourages families to try out the machine guns. I guess little kids now can make extra sure that Santa brings them everything they want. You will do it, right, Santa? And that's very, very ugly. Ouch! Ouch, ouch. Okay. We've covered a lot of territory today. I just want to recap very, very quickly. India, full-blown revolt. The government may even fall, Mr. Singh, over the fact that they want to open the country to multinational retail stores. The euro is wobbling. Herman Cain is deciding whether or not he's sold enough books. He's wobbling. Okay. Yeah, I guess you get the point. Brenda in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hey, Brenda, what's on your mind today? Brenda? No, Brenda. Okay. Can Do in New York City. Hey, Can Do, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First off, God forbid if that legislation passes, hopefully we can become sellies. You know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, right? But something that came to my attention back when Reagan was about to be inaugurated. I understand his people had some kind of hookup with the Iranians to release the hostages after his inauguration.
Yeah, Bill and, Casey had cut that deal with them.
Excuse me?
Bill Casey, who was his campaign manager and he made director of the CIA, had cut that deal with the Iranians. And then when Bill Casey was being subpoenaed to testify before Congress in the Iran-Contra hearings, told his lawyer, Milton Gould, that he was going to testify fully and honestly. In the morning of his testimony, he had a seizure in his office at the CIA. They took him to the hospital, and they cut out the left parietal lobe of his brain, the part of the brain that controls speech. And he died a few months later as a result of the surgery, but they basically cut his tongue out.
Great. You just made it worse. Because, you know, like, I live in New York. In fact, I live in Manhattan. I was here during 9/11 and whatnot. And, you know, I've always had people with all these conspiracy theories, but I'm like, nah, not my government, so on and so forth. But considering how I've seen Bush act in the last 8 years to the point where I actually feel like I've been victimized, and, you know, it's like I'm actually, like, entertaining these so-called conspiracies now to actually think that they actually had a hand in this thing, considering, like, Cheney's relationship with Halliburton, torture, and all this other stuff. I'm beginning to believe there's something really sinister going on here. And it's like, you know, I'm only thankful for you and a handful of other people that bring this out. And it's like, yo, this is mind-blowing. It makes me want, tell me, what can I do, man?
Well, I think, can do the thing that we, and thank you very much for the call, and thank you for your kind comments. I think that the obligation for all of us is, A, to educate ourselves, and B, to ask a lot of questions. You know, I want to know what happened with the anthrax attacks. I'd like to know what happened with 9/11. Clearly we don't know the whole story there. I'd like to know, you know, what happened, you know, how did we end up in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, how long was Bush planning that? How did it tie back into 1998 and the Project for New American Century, PNAC? And Rumsfeld and Cheney, and, you know, why was Halliburton almost bankrupt when Dick Cheney became vice president? And now they're headquartered in Dubai. I mean, they're no longer even an American corporation, or at least a KBR. There's a million questions. I think we need to start demanding answers, and we need to start holding politicians accountable. Beyond that, you know, get active, show up. Movement Politics, join Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, Democracy for America. There's a whole bunch of great groups out there, movetoamend.org. You know, sign up, participate, and let's infiltrate the political parties. If you're Republican inclined, show up at the Republican Party. If you're Democratically inclined, show up at the Democratic Party and become part of the system, or show up at the Green Party, whatever it may be. Get active. It's not the time for us to sit on our hands. It's time for us to get active. Devin in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Devin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm calling about the Radford Army Ammunition Plant yet again.
You have, you've called about that regularly. It's the situation is still the same, I'm assuming?
Well, actually, it's a little worse in that we discovered that the arsenal lied to the Government Accountability Office on their most recent report on perchloric contamination at federal facilities.
Right.
So we contacted our senators, and Ann Rust, who is the deputy secretary for Mark Warner, sent a letter, and then she just sent me an email. This is Ann Rust from Mark Warner's office, saying, don't contact us anymore about the arsenal. We don't want to hear from you. And if you do contact us, you need to send us a regular letter, not an email.
Okay.
So
it sounds like you've hit a nerve, Devin. Devin, I you know, and you've shared it with our listeners, and I wish you well, and keep us up to date on how it's going. I mean, this is a mess. It's a genuine mess. Rick in Southwest Missouri. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. First of all, you mentioned about the Udall bill.
Yeah.
I had a question. If you happen to know exactly what that bill is, what the number is.
I don't.
The second thing is that what I was hearing a couple of callers calling in, the thing that bothers me the most is that this thing about financial terrorism,
mm-hmm.
to me, I felt this for a while now. I feel like part of the Democratic Party, the Blue Dogs, and all of the Republican Party has been financial terrorists from day one, since they have not even worked with our president since he's been in office.
To the extent that they have, that the Republican Party in particular, the Blue Dogs, I think, is maybe too much of a generalization, but some Democrats, but in particular, to the extent, and thank you for the call, Rick, to the extent that the Republican Party is saying, no, we will not help fix this economy. And to the extent that as a consequence of that, people are still out of work, their homes are still underwater, they are, you know, divorces are happening, domestic violence is happening, horror stories, people are dying, people don't have insurance, they're all the horrors that go with this, you know, Great Bush Depression. Yeah, I would categorize them as terrorists as well. Bobby in Phoenix. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hi, apologies for my voice. I've got something going on that, anyway, I heard on Randy Rhodes, and this is in response to the violent revolution that I believe will happen. I did write a letter to Obama several months ago saying that if things go on like this, you're leaving the 99%ers gone, the foreclosures, et cetera. A lot of people are hungry, homeless, starving, et cetera. If you don't help these people, we're going to have a revolution, and it will not be a pretty sight. Well, Randy Rhodes did recited a list of all of the different police departments that are purchasing military-grade weapons. I believe this is in preparation for a violent revolution. And I'll get off the line and let you expound, and hopefully someone else can get on.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. Let me say, first of all, I can't speak to somebody else's show, but that list would be pretty much every police department, at least every significant police department in the United States. And there is a whole new industry, and it's really follow the dollar, in my opinion. I don't think that this is, you know, a grand plan to lock down America as a police state, although it may end up having that consequence. I think what it really is that you've got military contractors in this town who are hiring lobbyists who are showering millions of dollars on members of Congress, who are making money, military, the defense contractors, who are making money by pumping out weapons, military-grade weapons, that are very expensive, and they found a new customer for them. You know, they're not selling them to Saddam Hussein anymore so that he can fight the Iranians. They're selling them to the police departments, and they're making a fortune. I'd say follow the money. I mean, Occam's razor here. What's the simplest explanation? Somebody's making a buck on it. Now, the consequences might be really, really bad. I think that's the simplest explanation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, TomHartman.com. If you want to start a blog, create your own blog. Participate in our message board. Drop into our 24/7 chat room.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Talk radio, talk media, actually, talk radio and TV for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tony in South Hadley, Mass. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First time, long time.
Thank you.
I'm actually calling to complain about something I heard on the Diane Rehm show last week.
Okay, I don't listen to the show, so I can't respond to that.
I don't either, but it's more of the topic either.
Let's just talk about the topic rather than the show.
Very, very good. She had a couple guests on, and someone called up and said, complained about taxing the wealthy being considered class warfare.
Right.
And I was waiting for the show. Her show apparently is supposed to be a fair, balanced kind of a show, liberal and conservative views. I was waiting for one of the guests to kind of counter the theory and, talk about how the rich have loopholes and et cetera.
Right.
And no one actually said anything about it. And it was very frustrating to hear them all support the listener of the caller and say, yeah, you're right. It is kind of like class warfare, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And in fact, their class is winning. And that's the thing. Tony, thank you for the call. And this is the thing that, you know, Warren Buffett came right out and said it. He said, yes, there's class warfare in America and my class is winning. His class is 1%. He pays 17% in income taxes. That's his income tax rate. Because there's a special separate income tax rate for capitalists. It's called the capitalist gains tax rate, and it's 15%. That's the most you pay if you earn your money as a capitalist, as capitalist gains. 15%. If you earn your money as the secretary to the capitalist, you pay 35%. But, you know, yeah. So that it is class warfare. And to say that that 15%, that capitalist gains tax, or capital gains is what it's really called, that capitalist gains tax should be the same as the tax on people who actually work, well, that would put an end to the class warfare, wouldn't it? But it's going to be a long time before that happens. Dave in Connecticut. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi. I'm surprised that Bernie Sanders announced he's going to retire. Is that
No, it wasn't Bernie Sanders. It was Barney Frank.
Oh, okay. great.
No, Bernie Sanders is running for re-election. His website is bernie.org for his campaign.
Okay.
And get over and help him out. And
yeah,
Barney Frank said that when he...
I couldn't get in last week asking a question to Bernie Sanders, though.
Yeah.
Your female call screener wouldn't let me through.
Okay. Well, I don't know how I can address that, Dave. Libby in Seattle. Hey, Libby, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really am enjoying, I love your show in general, and today's been great. One thing I think people can really do is learn about how to start a state bank in their state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this single issue would do more to correct our economic woes faster than anything else I can think of.
Yep.
I would urge people to go to publicbankinginstitute.org. That's Ellen Brown's website. And just read the front page, and it is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's now up to 14 states, as you well know. And I think last year it was like 8.
Yeah.
And
where they're trying to do it. It only exists in one state, and that was put into place in 1919 in North Dakota.
Legislation is moving now at some point in about 14 states.
Yes.
So I think this, if we could just really focus on this as an issue, I think it would be maybe more than most things we could do. It would do more to correct the economic imbalances, get jobs moving, get some solutions going here.
Totally agree with you. And Ellen Brown is spot on about this. We did a Conversations with Great Minds with her. You can see that at conversationswithgreatminds.com, Public Banking Institute, and also webofdebt.com, her other website. Libby, I'm absolutely with you. Thank you for calling and raising the issue. Doug in Chicago. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great. What's on your mind?
I'm hoping you can do me a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Could you Google the phrase Diane Nash civil rights? If you do that,
I can't. I'm on the air, but you can tell me what happens.
You don't have to do it right now. But if you do that, you will be pleasantly surprised because there is a person who is really experienced in creating social change nonviolently. I called last week. It's my mom who does this. She's a lecturer. She goes around the world teaching this.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, tried to make herself available to the Occupy movement.
Okay, great. And you're out pitching her and her services, and that's a fine thing. Gary in Seattle. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. How is this language in the defense appropriation things not a suspension of the Bill of Rights?
Bill of Rights does not say that the military can't turn their guns on us. That's posse comitatus, which is only a law.
Well, I also read in the Seattle Times this morning that the FAA is looking to give clearance for a lot more drones over the cities of the United States now.
Right.
I mean, how long is it before they're armed or something? I mean, this is very dystopian, and this is very frightening to me.
It is extremely dystopian, and we need to be pushing back on it. It is... absolutely something we need to push back on.
And with no discussion.
Yeah, no, you're right. And, well, actually, I think the discussion is starting, Gary. It's just starting a little late. Thank you for the call. Howard in Arkansas. Howard, we have 1 minute left. What's up?
Well, I was going to talk about what the last talker was talking about. It's so broad spread. If you take money out of a major bank, could that be considered a terrorist act?
Yes, if you take out more than $5,000 from your bank, the bank has to report it to the, I believe it's the FBI. They have to report it to one of the federal agencies.
But is this America anymore? It sounds like we're in a communist country.
Well,
we have the right.
Communist is probably the wrong word, but because it wasn't really communist, it was it was authoritarian. But yeah, with the United States over the last 30 years, I mean this is the consequence of Reaganomics. This isn't the Opie and Andy Taylor world anymore. This isn't it's not Mayberry RFD any longer. It's now the world of George W. Bush and fear and Dick Cheney and being terrified and oh my God, the Muslims are coming to get us. And I mean they have. The Republicans used terror as a political tool against the United States, against America. It just blows my mind. Anyhow, we will be coming up tomorrow. What you need to know about lung cancer. We're going to be talking with R.L. Denson of Lung Cancer Leaders. The best of the rest of the news, and of course, the politics of the day and the news of the day. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you tag your it. Get out there, get active, occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.